First case on our calendar, 04-1130, Disciplinary Counsel versus Charles D. Cotton. Mr. Organ.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Sean Organ. I represent Mr. Cotton. I'm here today with co-counsel, Ms. Sherston Schoberg-Witt. This is a unique and interesting case, and I appreciate the opportunity to present it before the court and have the opportunity to argue it. The issue before the court is our objection to the recommendation on remand of the Board of Unauthorized Practice of Law. What's interesting about this case is it raises, I believe, an issue of first impression, and I believe it raises an intriguing competing interest that the state has. That competing interest is, how do they constitutionally meet the mandates of Johnson v. Avery, while at the same time strike a balance with their obligations to see to it that there's not the unauthorized practice law within the borders of Ohio? The reality is that the issue in this case, as it relates to Mr. Cotton, is can the state sponsor the unauthorized practice of law to meet one constitutional obligation, yet prosecute the same conduct against another inmate engaging in the same conduct? As the court is aware, because the court remanded it for additional evidence related to Johnson v. Avery, I will not go into how important the Great Writ is, the purpose for protecting the Great Writ and allowing inmates the opportunity to file. That's set out in Johnson v. Avery, and that's been the law for decades now. What I would like to quickly articulate is the standard as set out in Johnson v. Avery. Unless and until the state provides some reasonable alternative to assist inmates in the preparation of petitions for post-conviction relief, it may not validly enforce a regulation barring such inmates from furnishing such assistance to other prisoners.
Counsel, could you, and I'm interested in knowing from both sides, some factual background. This got started, I believe, not as a result from a complaint from a lawyer who lost business or from an inmate who was poorly served by your client.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It got started by a referral to the disciplinary counsel from the clerk of this court, is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And you took some depositions in the gathering of evidence. Was there any indication that your client and his assistance to other inmates was interfering with the normal or the normal operation of the prison, or in any way represented any inconvenience to the administration of the prison where he's housed?
No, Your Honor. In fact, quite to the contrary, we did take multiple depositions. We took the depositions of the four inmate law clerks as well as two librarians and the warden. And to a person, no one articulated any problems with him providing the services. Actually,
the warden had no complaint himself.
By my knowledge, there was no complaints related to the service he was providing.
And was there any indication that there were inmates who felt they had been misled as to your client's expertise? In other words, they relied on him when they should have been getting family members to try and scrape together the money to get a private lawyer. Any complaint from an inmate who had been served by him?
Not based on the evidence in the record, Your Honor, and not to my knowledge.
Okay, and then finally, would it be true that had he not been so wanting to take credit for this, he put his name on some of this stuff, didn't he?
He did, Your Honor. There were four specific exhibits.
Had he not done that,
this would not be an issue.
We wouldn't even be aware of him. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
because I assume there are other inmates and clerks in libraries who are inmates who provide assistance who don't put their names on briefs.
Your Honor, based upon the depositions that were taken, there are four inmate law clerks at London Correctional Institute, and in addition, somewhere between 5 and 20 jailhouse lawyers that are continuing to operate within the institution.
Mr. Organ, that's the area that I'd like to inquire about. How does your client differ from the inmate law clerks who are participating on behalf of inmates?
Your Honor, to a person, we asked that very question of each of the inmates, and each of the inmates stated that they do exactly what Mr. Cotton does.
And their training is what?
Their training is actually non-existent. Inmate Price, did you receive any training when you became a law clerk here at London? Answer by Mr. Price to Ms. Shirsten Schoberg-Witt. No, ma'am. Did you ever meet with an attorney to get any training from an attorney on using the law library? Answer, no, ma'am. Did any of the other law clerks that you knew of ever receive any training from an attorney? Not to my knowledge. From Mr. Devers, do any attorneys come in and train any of you guys? Answer, no. From inmate Jasper, is there any formal training that you received as part of your job? Answer, orientation, but it's like 5 minutes and basically the books are on, they show you what books are on the shelves. So it's the distinction is not one of training. And the work being done, and I apologize for reading, but I think the facts are important in this case, and I think the depositions were extremely insightful. We talked to a Mr. Price, a very engaging inmate who helps service these inmates and serves as an inmate legal clerk. I asked him, as a legal clerk at London, what sort of job responsibilities? Answer, well, aside from inventory and maintaining accurate records, I assist inmates in research, I assist them in the preparation and filing of appeals and post-conviction actions. I advise them on what I believe to be the best avenue to take in certain situations because, you know, nobody's case is alike. So it would be different advice for different people and try to point them in the right direction. And there are inmates who do not possess the capacity to file their own appeals or do their own research. As I said, I'll do the work for them.
Well, to follow up on Justice Pfeiffer's point, do the inmate clerks sign their name to pleading?
That is the one distinction, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
That is the one distinction between Mr. Cotton and the other 5 to 20 jailhouse lawyers and the inmate law clerks. And on that point, as I said, there are four exhibits. Let me make 2 points. Number one, the Department of Corrections does provide a policy manual. In the policy manual, it identifies that inmates are permitted to assist one another. And it also provides, quote, no inmate shall use the words lawyer, attorney at law, counselor at law, law office, esquire, or other equivalent words in connection with his or her own name, either in writing or orally, in an effort to induce others to believe that he, she is an attorney. The testimony unequivocally was, Mr. Cotton has never held himself out as an attorney. You mentioned the filings. The filings that do distinguish him from others, I have them here in front of me. There is no word attorney. Attorney at law, there's no counsel, there's no assistant counsel, counsel of record, esquire. He holds himself out as pro se assistant, in one pro se assistance, I assume is a typo, with his inmate number. It is not lost on anyone who sees this that he's never.
We look beyond what he calls himself, don't we, to see, to determine exactly what service he's providing to decide whether he's offering legal services or not.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
The fact that you said he doesn't list his name as attorney or, you know, you can't tell from what how he identifies himself that he's acting as a lawyer. But don't we look, that's not significant. Don't we look to see that, don't we look at the functions, at his activity, determine whether he's actually acting as a lawyer? That's what we do in other cases.
I agree with you, Your Honor, absolutely. And my point is that he has never held himself out as a lawyer, and even in the evidence that's been provided, he doesn't hold himself out as a lawyer. He holds himself out as a pro se assistant inmate.
Although we do have something in the record here that says he's held himself out as graduating from law school magna cum laude. Is that correct?
My understanding is his deposition was taken, and he answered some question to that effect. I was not in attendance, and we had not been retained at that point.
Which does not appear to be the case, though. Is that correct?
I do not believe that he possesses a law degree.
Well, counsel, in paragraph 54 of the final report, or excuse me, 58, it states all four inmate clerks have advanced education and training and have earned a college degree or a paralegal certificate. and/or have earned substantial credits in pursuit of a college degree. And you indicated that they had no legal training, but this states a paralegal certificate.
They're given no legal training when they become an inmate law clerk. As far as their educational background, I will tell you from the depositions, two of them are intelligent people who do dramatic assistance to each of the inmates that they help. They go well beyond serving as a paralegal. They serve as an attorney, in fact. They simply don't hold themselves out as an attorney. They don't sign anything. It's sort of don't ask, don't tell. Having said that, the two other law clerks, inmate law clerks, one considers himself illiterate. He says, yes, I have a college degree. I earned it while I was in prison, and would not say that he would not fall within the category of the number of individuals who are illiterate within the prison system. So I don't think we can read too much into the fact that they have a college degree or a GED.
Counsel, the conundrum I have in this case is that we very carefully protect the practice of law. We believe that it's necessary for the protection of the public. We limit the ability of companies who could have a great deal of legal training to come in and do wills and trusts without the title. We don't allow attorneys from other states to practice here without taking our bar or getting reciprocity. We have drawn limits around real estate and workers' comp. And here, if you get a criminal conviction, you earn the right to, in essence, practice law if you just follow with certain guidelines that you're urging us to. And the conundrum I have is it better to have somebody try to do it on their own or allow a now convicted defendant who would never be able to do anything remotely like that in the outside world to give legal advice and assistance without any legal training or background? And so don't we run such a risk of creating further damage or danger to an inmate because we have this untrained person, we now say, because you are convicted, you can practice law?
Those are excellent points, and I think the obligation of the state to protect the rights of the state to have licensed attorneys servicing them is extremely important. But that's what the court weighed in Johnson v. Avery. They balanced that against the great writ and the constitutional right that an inmate has to file. And they said, we have to solve this problem, and how do we solve it? And they say, at the end of the day, the state has no right to prohibit these jailhouse lawyers from operating as long as, or unless and until they can show that they provide some other meaningful access to the court system. What the state has is an opportunity to provide that meaningful access. If they can do that, then Mr. Cotton has no right to be doing what he's doing.
And the state maintains that they've met that burden as set out in Avery. You maintain they have not?
I maintain that they cannot meet that burden by merely providing a law library, and they certainly cannot say, but we don't just provide a law library. We also have inmate law clerks who are doing the exact same thing Mr. Cotton's doing. My point is, if from an equal protection standpoint, we preclude everyone from practicing law, they don't meet the Johnson v. Avery standard, then Mr. Cotton is permitted to do what he's doing.
Has he ever applied to become an inmate law clerk?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Might be an easy solution here.
Well, it isn't, though, because in essence, what we have is we still have the clashing of issues that no court has really spoken to, which is we have the unauthorized practice of law occurring in our prison system, and we're turning a blind eye to it in order to meet our Johnson v. Avery obligations. And that's what this case, and why I say it's a case of first impression, this is the first case I can find anywhere where this clash has occurred, where it's not the inmates bringing a class action lawsuit and Justice Scalia saying they have no standing. It's not the state or the prison saying you're not allowed to do this, like in Johnson v. Avery. It's disciplinary counsel saying you can't practice without a license. The only place that appears in any of these cases is footnote 11 in Johnson v. Avery. They raised it and they said, isn't this a potential quandary?
And do we not have the right to regulate the practice of law, whether they're in prison or out of prison?
Absolutely.
Or does the U.S. Avery case trump that?
Johnson v. Avery trumps the state's rights to regulate the unlicensed practice of law.
But have they addressed that question directly? I mean, have they said that as a state cannot regulate the practice of law if somebody gets a conviction?
Yes, absolutely. They specifically have said that, if I understand your question correctly, they've specifically said that the rights of a state to regulate the practice of law within its borders is trumped by the right of an inmate to have access to the court system. That's what the entire basis of Johnson v. Avery is. And unless and until the state can show that meaningful access, they can't prohibit Mr. Johnson from serving as a jailhouse lawyer.
Counsel, then what would be meaningful access in your view?
I mean, here the state says we have the library, we have the individuals who can help people research and do their own petitions. If that's not meaningful access, what is?
Meaningful access is exactly that, a law library plus some level of assistance. Meaningful access to the over, we can quibble from a factual standpoint as to how many illiterate inmates there are, but meaningful access is not merely a law library at that point. So there must be some assistance. There must be an assistance component. My point is the assistance component in this instance is the utilization of inmates who are practicing law without a license. So on the one hand, the state's sponsoring the practice of law without a license, and on the other hand, they're prosecuting the practice of law without a license.
Is there anything that indicates whether there was any remuneration paid to your client in any form for
No,
any
quite
of
to the
services?
Contrary, Your Honor.
Does the record show anything in that regard?
Nothing. To the contrary, every person asked said that he's never charged a penny of anyone.
Thank Counsel, you. The means by which an inmate in your client's situation would show that an inmate other than himself was denied his constitutional right of access to the courts would be the identification of a specific case and then a loss by that inmate in an attempt to address an issue in court. Is that correct?
Are you referring to the standing component?
Pardon me?
Are you referring to the standing component as articulated in Lewis?
Yeah.
This is unique in this instance because in those cases, in all those cases, the common thread is that it was an inmate trying to assert their right. In this instance, Mr. Cotton is not trying to assert his right and claim that he has a constitutional right to serve these inmates. He's defending himself against the charge that he's practicing without a license. So from a standing point, he has standing by virtue of the claim that was brought against him. So that's really not the same analysis.
So we don't need to show that an inmate's case was not pursued, a redress was lost as a result of the inadequacy of the law library and the assistance offered by the penal institution?
No, for two reasons, three things I can articulate. One is in Johnson v. Avery, that case would have never gotten to the Supreme Court if there had been a standing issue. Second, this is a defense that's being raised by my client, not an affirmative case that he has the burden of proof. And third, under Johnson v. Avery standard, the burden rests with the state, almost as a condition precedent. Before you can tell Cotton he can't do what he's doing, you've got to show that there's meaningful access. And my whole quibble with all of this is the law libraries are great, but you can't prove meaningful access by sponsoring the practice of law by inmates and then prosecute an inmate. That's the only point I'm trying to make here today. And that's where I think the clash, the issue of first impression
comes
to.
What's the standard, though, for adequacy? You said it's not enough to have a law library with 3,000, volumes in it. It's the quality of the assistance. And if the state is shown that there's four assistants, and whether you quibble with their educational level or their competency, what's the standard to say that that is inadequate? Where is that written?
What's fascinating about this entire body of law and what I find interesting about the case is when you look at Johnson v. Avery, it seems to suggest a law library, maybe a little more would be good. Then you see this whole body of law that sort of, some say a law library alone is enough. Some say a law library plus a little more assistance would be good. But then Justice Scalia says, none of that's right. The test is, are they capable of having a meaningful hearing within the courts or access to the courts? That's the test. The rest of it is the method by which they're capable of having that access. So there is no test. There's not a library plus or inmates. It's a factual determination, and that's why we delved into the facts in this case to say, is this a situation where these inmates are being served? And we could go on for hours about how, three inmates really doesn't adequately serve the number of inmates. The illiteracy rate, because it's sky high, is a huge problem. But in this case, I think the law library coupled with assistance would be sufficient. That's what we have, except that assistance is being supplied by inmates practicing law without a license, precisely what they're prosecuting my client for.
So you're suggesting the only way you could have a UPL against an inmate is if you had a real attorney, a licensed attorney giving assistance with this law library?
I don't think the courts have gone that far, Your Honor. I think the courts have said that you have to have somebody who can provide assistance. They can't practice law without a license, but no one's drawn that definitive line as to what, how far can they push it. They've advocated law students from Vanderbilt and Johnson v. Avery. They've advocated paralegals. We see that consistently. Inmate law clerks, but no court has articulated inmate law clerks, but only up to this point before you're treading on the unauthorized practice of law. That's what, again, what makes this case very unique and very interesting. I think the correct answer in all of that is probably paralegal assistance, not operating as attorneys, plus the assistance or the guidance of some attorneys in some instances, not on site, but something along those lines. I actually think all of this could be remedied and costs could be saved, but that's best set for another day.
Thank you, Mr. Organ.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Berger.
May it please the court, Robert Berger for Relator, Office of Disciplinary Counsel.
Mr. Berger, before you get rolling with your argument, I want to give you the opportunity to respond to the same question I put to the appellant's counsel, and that is, on the pure facts of the case, you heard his response to my questions. Is there any factual dispute about how this got started, who complained, whether or not any inmate voiced the opinion that they had been ill-served by this gentleman?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to indicate any inmate has filed a complaint against the respondent, nor is there anything in the record to indicate that the respondent's services are needed, beneficial, or have actually achieved any positive results for any inmates. So the record is silent in that
regard. Okay. Well, several folks were deposed. You don't disagree that the warden is not objecting to Mr. Cotton's assistance in the filing of inmate.
Your Honor, I don't recall the warden being asked that question in her deposition, so I don't know that there was an answer given in the record. What I will say is the prison has specific regulations prohibiting a person holding themselves out as a paralegal or an attorney, and that all four of the inmate clerks and the two librarians indicated in their deposition testimony that placing your name on the pleading of another or signing the pleading of another was violating the prison rules for that reason.
The final factual question I have is, was there anything in the development of this case that indicated that Mr. Cotton was providing substandard assistance, that is, that his assistance was not equal to the assistance of the other, whatever their title is, the folks who work in the library?
Your Honor, that is not developed in the record. There's yeah. No
so the clerk's,
of that.
So the clerk's referral was not based on this guy is filing or helping people file all this junk that's getting bounced
It's my understanding the clerk's referral was based upon receiving pleadings that had somebody other than the inmate grievance name on
it. So it was based strictly on his name and not on deficiencies of filings or anything of that nature.
That's correct. Right. My understanding that the clerk's office would return those pleadings to the respondent, and when he continued to submit them, it was at that point they made
okay.
The referral.
Thank you.
Mr. Berger, I want to keep you in the record for a moment. Does the record reflect the fact that our Supreme Court library provides many, many copies of statutes and cases to inmates who request them?
I don't believe that's developed in the record.
No one testified to that, apparently.
Counsel, what I'm hearing then is the only distinction between what Mr. Cotton does and what the law clerks that are designated by the prison to be law clerks within the library is that Mr. Cotton put his name on a document, and these law clerks within the institution did not ever. Is that basically the distinction here?
Your Honor, I would add slightly to that. When the board examined that question, they found that the respondent's conduct was different for two reasons. They said the respondent's level of participation in the litigation was different than the inmate clerks, and they found that the level of the respondent's control over the litigation was different than the inmate clerks.
And would you elaborate on that? What does that mean?
Certainly. They found that the respondent was conducting legal research, providing legal advice, drafting, revising, and preparing legal pleadings, and acting as if he was legal counsel for these individual inmates. On the other hand, the board's opinion indicates they viewed the inmate clerks as more providing what you would traditionally call assistance, somebody coming to them with the question, I want to appeal my conviction, and the inmate clerk assisting them in finding a book or assisting them in finding a form.
But I thought the testimony from the inmate law clerks is that they, you know, help them fill in the blanks on, you know, pre-printed forms and give them the advice about what form would be appropriate. Would you agree with that? That that's what the record reflected?
The inmate clerks indicated that they did engage in similar activity. They also indicated...
All right. So my question is, are we just talking a matter of degrees here? We have Mr. Cotton, who is maybe doing a larger volume than the law clerks, but in essence, they're doing many of the same things.
Based upon the board's opinion, I think you can conclude that it was the board's opinion that the respondent was conceiving this litigation and driving the litigation. It was more than just providing advice or assistance.
So are you saying conceiving the litigation where he independently reviewed an inmate's situation, came to him and said, hey, listen, I think you have a good case here?
The board found that he was speaking with inmates and providing legal advice.
Well, who initiated it? Was that determined by the record? Did the inmates seek out Mr. Cotton, or did he seek out them?
I don't believe there's specific testimony in the record regarding who initiated the contact.
Mr. Berger, I appreciate the position that you're here. What I'm confused about is you're not objecting to the inmate law clerks. Am I right?
Your Honor, at this point in time, we have received no complaints about the work done by the inmate law clerks. Further, based upon the information we have, it's our position that what the respondent is doing is well beyond what the inmate law clerks are doing for several of the reasons that I've already mentioned, as well as he placed his name on every pleading, announcing to the world that he was the person that drafted, revised, and prepared that pleading. And in five instances, he actually signed the pleading. And there's but one reason why you would place your name on the pleading of another person, and that is to announce to everyone that you are that individual's advocate. We don't believe the other parties that were providing services were filling the same role that the respondent was filling.
And if Mr. Cotton would refrain from doing that, and the same pleadings would get filed, perhaps with the inmate signature, there wouldn't be any other indication of what activity level was being conducted behind the bars of the penitentiary.
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, initially when this grievance was filed, I sent a letter to Mr. Cotton advising him of the fact that he needed to cease his behavior, and he could have certainly said he was going to quit and stopped putting his name on him. We would not have known. Nonetheless, he refused to do so because he believes that he has a constitutional right to act as an attorney for these parties.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Berger.
So is that an appropriate resolution to this case, that this court orders him the very limited command, don't put your name on any pleadings that come to the Supreme Court or any other court? Is that all we're here about?
Your Honor, in this instance, Relator felt as if we couldn't walk away from a situation where somebody who's a non-lawyer is placing their name on the pleadings of other parties.
So we are concerned with his name appearing on a document and being filed with this court or any other court in this state.
That's correct.
So if he refrains from doing it, there's no internal mechanism that we have within the institution to be watchful to determine that he's not pursuing these activities.
We would rely on the prison system to enforce your order. It's my understanding that if such an order was made by the court, the prison system would use that as a mechanism to enforce that order on the respondent.
Doesn't the prison system already have a rule that an inmate's not supposed to act as an attorney or a paralegal? And if so, why isn't that already being enforced?
Your Honor, I cannot speak for the prison. It's my understanding that the respondent was advised on different occasions that certain things that he was doing were not appropriate, such as placing his name on pleadings. So, but why they did or did not take additional enforcement action, I do not know. That that's not developed in the record.
The realtor doesn't just seek, or the recommendation from the board isn't just that he stop putting his name. I mean, that's a facial treatment of a very serious issue. They're looking at prohibiting him from giving, acting as an attorney all along the way, not just putting the name on. Isn't that what they're seeking?
That's correct, Your Honor. We would ask this court to enjoin the respondent from engaging in the unauthorized practice of law, much the same as this court does in other cases involving parties who are not
attorneys.
I guess
to follow up on Justice Stratton's question, I'm a little confused by your responses to other questions, that it seemed to me you were agreeing that the only issue here was whether or not he puts his name on documents that are filed in courts. But I thought you also said that he was, and the board says, that he was engaging in conduct that is different than the conduct in which the legal assistants are engaging in the institution. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the difference is that if someone comes to me, I'm an inmate, and I come to you as another inmate, and I say, I've got this form, I'm not sure what word to put in here, and you tell me, well, the word is plaintiff or whatever, that's one thing. But if it's, I'm not sure what argument I should be making here. I think I was treated wrongly by the Court of Appeals, the trial court. How do I make that argument? And you say to me, well, here's how you make the argument. That's different, is it not? And I thought that's what the board's distinction was. That's far different than saying just putting your name, that the issue before us is whether we tell him to stop putting his name on a document. Am I correct? Am I wrong?
That's correct, Your Honor, and I believe it was that basis that the board found that the respondent's level of participation in the litigation and his level of control over it were greater than what the inmate clerks, the services.
That's what they mean, what you mean by driving the litigation. That's more than just saying, well, you need revised code section 2513, I'll get it for you. I'll call the Supreme Court and they'll get it for you, whatever. That's far different than saying, giving somebody strategy or telling them how the chances of their winning are, whatever. It seems to me that's the issue, I think, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, the words that he used in his notation that he placed on each of those over 30 documents say, drafted, revised, and prepared by. At the respondent's deposition, he attempted to walk away from that and say that that meant that he corrected spelling or helped with typing, but it's clear from the very words that he used that he was providing services beyond just mere assistance.
Counsel, I think it would be fair to say that certainly at the Supreme Court level, I don't have any way of knowing at the appellate and the trial court level, pro se inmate litigation has a very low success rate. And one of the problems, before you ever get to the legal issues that the inmate is trying to raise, huge problem, is the procedure. What you have to file, what you have to do in terms of affidavits to show that you have no money so that filing fees can be waived, timeliness of filing, how many copies. I mean, it's just a plethora of procedural hoops that get you bounced if you don't follow all of those. Do these law clerks, I assume that Cotton has become somewhat knowledgeable on those kinds of things and is providing that kind of assistance, because you did not indicate the clerk's office sent it over saying, hey, this guy is following up all these people's rights by filing stuff that gets tossed before it ever gets reviewed by anyone. On the procedural standpoint, do you know from the depositions taken, do the other law clerks assist in that regard with these procedural hoops?
Your Honor, my reading of the inmate law clerk's depositions is, in general terms, they spoke about the services that they provided. I don't recall specific descriptions of assistance with procedural kinds of issues.
Because it would seem to me that the requirements of Johnson versus Avery would at least requires something more than just here are the books, here's the revised code, here's the Supreme Court rules, that for presumably many of these inmates have difficulty reading in the first place, for them to fight their way through all of that with just here's the books. The trap would be that they would never get to a judge for a merit review of whatever issue they want to raise because they fall down on the procedural requirements. But you don't know. And let me follow up with that. Would the disciplinary council regard that as the practice of law? That is, assistance by the law clerks or Mr. Cotton with the procedural aspects of it, forgetting the legal merits of the inmate's case.
Your Honor, in a general sense as described by you, I can't imagine that would be something we would feel a necessity to bring a formal pleading about. The inmate law clerks in the libraries already provide some basic assistance. The record reveals there were, I think, 36 different kinds of standard pleadings, like a pleading to not have to pay court filing fees due to the fact that you were indigent, or some of the other more basic pleadings. So there already are some procedural mechanisms and some assistance in place to help these inmates find their way.
So having those is at least a part of the state's attempt to meet the mandates of Johnson versus Avery, then?
That's my understanding. It's a part of what's provided in the library.
Well, counsel, who would discuss with an illiterate, indigent inmate what a statute actually says? If you're saying that the law clerks point the inmate to Ohio Revised Code chapter 29, and they pull that down, and obviously they cannot read, who is there within the legal or the prison system to read the sections that are applicable, synopsize it so that the illiterate inmate can understand it, and devise then an appropriate response?
All right, Your Honor, there are several different mechanisms in place to assist illiterate inmates. It begins with an assessment when they're first convicted to determine what their educational level is. During orientation, they're made aware of various literacy programs. There's a special literacy dormitory for inmates. There also is a school, there's a special education teacher, and also pursuant to the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction rules, the inmate law clerks can provide services to illiterate inmates to assist them in reading and drafting.
So, to assist them in reading and drafting, in other words, to interpret the statute for them?
They would not be interpreting the statute, they would be merely communicating what is in the record and assisting them in writing if they do not have the ability to write.
So they would actually pen the response, because these people that are illiterate wouldn't be able to literally write.
If that was the circumstance, they could provide them with help in typing or writing, yes.
Okay, so you say that the literacy program within the institution is a sufficient response to an illiterate inmate desiring interpretation of Revised Code Chapter 29.
What I'm saying is there's nothing in the record to indicate that is not the case. The board did examine all of the literacy programming and found that it provided adequate access to both literate and illiterate inmates.
Mr. Berger, is there anything in the record that shows what sort of guidance inmates are given as to what kind of assistance they can provide that does not reach the practice of law or the rendering of legal services for another? We're just having a discussion here about what legal services means, what the practice of law means, what you can do and cannot do. We're talking about people who are in our prison system, and we don't want them to go outside the bounds, but yet to be able to do whatever they can do inside the bounds. What does the record reflect? Any kind of guidelines for the inmates to follow so they don't run afoul of engage in unauthorized practice of law?
Your Honor, the only written guidelines that I'm aware of and that are also in the record are the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction policy. And the only two things that it says on that issue is, number one, inmates are permitted to assist each other, and number two, an inmate cannot hold themselves out as a paralegal or an attorney. They don't define specifically what the practice of law is or what constitutes assistance versus what constitutes the practice of law.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berger.
Thank you.
Mr. Organ, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. In light of the questions that were asked, I just want to read one section from a deposition transcript of Mr. Benjamin Price. He was asked, have you ever revised documents like that for inmates? Answer, yes, I do. In situations like that, I'll tell the inmates, quote, just give me the facts of the case, and I'll look at the facts and see how the law applies to it, and then try to present an argument, a persuasive argument for the court. I submit to the court, if that's not the practice of law, I don't know what is. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.